Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Plexaderm. And, okay, we have to do this. We have to talk about Nikki Haley. Nikki Haley's comments over the weekend. She's got a new book out. And who better to talk about this than our good friend, Tom Nichols. Good to have you back, Professor.
Hey, Charlie. Good to be back with you.
All right, let's talk about this. So, Nikki Haley has written a new book that does seem to have the proverbial audience of one, assuring Donald Trump that despite everything he might have heard or thought about her, that she was absolutely totally loyal, and she essentially drops a dime on John Kelly and Rex Tillerson, who she said were trying to undermine the president because they thought it was necessary to save the country. So they went to her and they said, "Would you help us save the country?" And Nikki's like, "No, I'm not interested in that. I'm all in on Donald Trump, just in case anybody has any doubt about this." So let's just talk about, you know, Nikki Haley. I tweeted out over the weekend that Nikki is not the one that you have been waiting for. And this feels so familiar. Doesn't this feel familiar, though, Tom, that it's like, you know, just somebody else that you worked yourself up into thinking this is the person who's going to stand on principle. This is the person who's going to rescue us. And it's like,
no, I know, it's like those scenes in Rosemary's Baby where every time she thinks she's found a sympathetic doctor or something, turns out to be one more part of the coven, you know, where they suddenly start, you know, handing her back over to the bad guys. Or it's almost it would be funny if it weren't tragic that, you know, there's always this sense that there's one more really good Republican in hiding, you know, that we just have to go find that one last person, you know, who's not in on the cult. And, you know, the thing about the Nikki Haley story that really struck me, does anybody come out of that looking good, including Nikki Haley? Seriously?
Interesting.
Nobody. Okay. I mean, nobody looks good at the end of that, including Haley herself. I mean, Nikki Haley has been sitting on it for the sake of a book. She's been sitting on the knowledge that John Kelly and Rex Tillerson came to her and said, the president has no idea what he's doing. The country's in danger.
And people will die. You
know, and yeah. People will die. And Haley said, well, my principled response to that is to quit the government, go into hiding for a while, write a book, and then reemerge and rat everybody out and make it seem like I was the principled one. I'm sorry, it doesn't read that way. It reads like I'm going to wait for you guys to get turfed. I'm jumping off of this, you know, sinking ship. I'm going to wait for you guys to get turfed by Trump. And then when it comes time, I'm going to scoop up what's left of the Trump base for my own political purposes. And I think she's making the same mistake that Rubio and Cruz and Paul and all the rest of them made in 2016 of saying, you know, when Donald Trump finally goes down, I will be the beneficiary and I will scoop up what's left of his coalition. Mm. And I just think that's wrong. I think David Frum had put it really well.
I was going to mention him, yeah.
Yeah, you know, when David said, that's the equivalent of people who thought derivatives were a really good idea right up until the day they weren't.
Well, but David Frum is also pointing out that she's making a calculation that the future of the Republican Party will look a lot like Donald Trump, that it will be a Trumpian future post-Trump. And she's basically all in on that, right?
Yeah, and I don't think she's wrong. Mm. You know, I mean, I actually think that the Republican Party, especially because of impeachment, and maybe this is, you know, a contrarian opinion, but I think impeachment is actually going to doom the Republican Party. If it wasn't already, impeachment will do it. And so, yeah, the Republican Party is going to be a Southern and Western regional party whose strength is primarily a reflection of the Electoral College. Well, and sure, maybe
which elects presidents.
She's the perfect, you know, she's the perfect candidate for that, maybe.
But I want to come back to that in just a moment. You made the point, though, about how she, you know, kept quiet about this attempt to undermine the president until now. So she's being dragged a little bit by some of the pro-Trump folks on Twitter, where like, what you're just telling us this now, that the deep state approached you, or the shallow state, whatever you want to call Rex Tillerson, approached you, and you did not speak out about all of this. So it does seem to be so nakedly cynical on her part to take these guys and throw them under the bus of her 2024 campaign. By the way, I heard that on one of the cable shows, so I've stolen that line. I mean the obvious play here is that she is kissing up to Trump and his base. She's showing her absolute loyalty with a possible Hail Mary pass of getting on the ticket. I mean, if she was serious about getting on the ticket, replacing Mike Pence on the ticket, would she be behaving any differently than she is right now? No.
No. And again, this is what I mean about, does anybody end up looking good out of this story? I mean, on the one hand, if you're a Trumper, you look at Nikki Haley and you say, oh, so you knew that, you know, there was this cabal, this coterie, you know, of rich old, you know, four-star generals and rich old white guys trying to take down Trump, you know, with the inner circle and all that stuff. On the other hand, if you are anti-Trump, you say to yourself, oh, so you knew that there were adults in the room who were trying to enlist you in that cause because they believed that the president, you know, is this out of control ignoramus. And you didn't say anything about that either. You basically went to New York and went to some nice cocktail parties and made a few good speeches at the UN. And by the way, let's not take too much away from Haley. She was a perfectly serviceable UN ambassador. You know, one of the few bright spots back in that day in Trump's foreign policy. But that, you know, you were living a good life in New York and you were letting all the other guys do the heavy lifting. There's no version of this that makes her look good.
What's interesting about this is you recall that when she left that position as UN ambassador, she was one of the very few people who had left, gone into the Trump administration and left the Trump administration with their reputation completely intact. So at the moment she left, she was really unsullied by Trump and for some reason now has decided to double back and say, no, just so you know. And plus, I'm all in on impeachment. So let's talk about impeachment, because, and I'm not going to play the audio of this because everybody's heard it 100 times, where she says, you know, this is ridiculous. Look at the transcript. There's nothing in the transcript that warrants the death penalty for the president. Leave that aside. Ukrainians never did the investigation. President released the funds. No harm, no foul. And more than that, she said, I think the biggest thing that bothers me is the American people should decide this. Why do we have a bunch of people in Congress making this decision? There's just so much wrong there.
It's all I can hear when she says that is you know, Mayor Quimby in The Simpsons when he's told that he has to go through another election. He says, what? Again? Stupid Constitution.
the bunch of people.
Why do we have these people in Congress who get to decide it? I don't know. There's this thing in the National Archive. Everybody goes and visits it. It's an old yellowed piece of paper. It says some words and stuff. Something about that. But, you know, your point initially about all this is, I mean, why is she the moth that feels the need to fly right back at the bug zap? She got away, and she got away clean. And it just goes to show you that, you know, people who make their life in politics, you know, and I, I've been a defender of the political class forever, because I think I would never have run for office because I worked for politicians and I saw what they went through. But sometimes their self-regard and their need to be in office is so astoundingly large. You would think that Haley would be sitting down in South Carolina right now, you know, looking for a kind of prestigious, I don't know, think tank presidency or something to say, wow, I served in the Trump administration. I was a UN ambassador and I got away unscathed. And instead, she's doubling, as you say, she's doubling back to say, I didn't get any dirt on me. Let's see if I can do a face plant into the mud wallow and make me and everybody I ever knew look bad and get a tweet shouting my book out from Donald Trump, which
mission accomplished.
Right. Mission accomplished. I mean, so, you know, that just says that when Trump is over, the Trumpers are never going to trust her because she didn't say anything the first time. And people like me are never going to trust her because I think she was more pro-Trump than she let on. So I guess I don't understand it. And her approach to impeachment, I mean, does anybody read the Constitution?
Well, see, this is the thing. And this is the bunch of people are elected representatives of the American people. The Constitution specifically authorizes them to make this decision. The impeachment provision is every bit as much of the Constitution as the Electoral College, as, you know, anything else. And it is interesting hearing all of these, you know, advocates for the Constitution who are willing to sacrifice anything in order to get judges who will be, you know, will honor the Constitution. When this comes up, it's like, yeah, except for that.
Well, it's almost,
I mean, imagine a Constitution that did not have an impeachment provision, that once you were elected president, that you were immune from the law, that you could abuse your power, that you could do absolutely anything, and there was no recourse. You could commit any crime, and there would be no recourse except to wait until the next election. Is that really now the new originalist view of the Constitution, or the new tribal position that presidents, in fact, are above accountability, except at the ballot box?
Well, there's two things that come out of the position of people like Haley. One is, first of all, they really don't understand the Constitution they serve, or if they do, they're being disingenuous, because in a parliamentary system, of course, there is no mechanism for impeachment, and the founders, being the British citizens that they were, they knew this, but that's because there was a vote of no confidence, and you could collapse the parliament and send the whole business back to the people, you know, in a day, if you really had to. I mean, in 1979, you know, Great Britain had two general elections within 6 weeks because they couldn't get a clear result from the British people. We don't have that option. We have fixed terms of office. And so impeachment is specifically that remedy. That comes to the second part, though, which it seems like the Republicans have developed this novel theory of government, that the Constitution only functions at certain points in a presidential term. So if the president's in his last term of office, he doesn't get to nominate any Supreme Court appointments. You know, the power of appointment only functions for 7 out of 8 years, you know, on the Merrick Garland kind of theory. Or Haley and the others on impeachment. Well, you know, he was just elected, so you can't, it's the Goldilocks approach, right? He was just elected, so you can't impeach him. Well, now it's too close to an election, so you can't impeach him because we're having an election. It's almost like they think impeachment can only function if you're exactly at, you know, 1 year and 360 days into a term, and then at 1 year and 370 days, you have to wait again. And it's nonsense. Yeah. It's palpable nonsense.
It's also interesting how lame her no harm, no foul defense is here, because, I mean, I think we know this.
There's some dead Ukrainians who disagree with it.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the reason that the quid pro quo, and we can talk about whether we should use Latin anymore, the reason it didn't happen was, you know, and the money wasn't withheld, was basically, I mean, it's been explained over and over again. Basically, they were busted. You know, Congress found out about it. The media was found out about this weird delay in early September and started putting pressure on Trump, you know, about it before Zelensky had a chance to go on Fareed Zakaria's CNN show to announce the investigation. So they aborted the quid pro quo because, frankly, they had been caught and was about to become a big political downside. And now that's kind of the ultimate defense. So now you mentioned something. You think that the impeachment's really going to be bad for the Republicans. Tomorrow, of course, Wednesday, we have the beginning of the public impeachment hearings. The impeachment will be televised. I think this is fascinating, watching the Republicans who've been complaining about this has not been transparent enough, this has been behind closed doors, and yet they're also complaining about the fact that now be careful what
mad,
you wish for.
Here it comes. Well, I think the reason it'll be bad for Republicans is that once all this is over, I think, let me backtrack and say, the Mueller report and some of the other I think crimes of the Trump administration, it was tough for people to get their arms around it. This is easy. This is hurting an ally who's in trouble against our worst enemy in an actual firefight, and abandoning them and holding them hostage for purely personal gain. This is the easiest and clearest example of abuse of power there is. And Republicans are going to have to stand up and, I mean, the House, forget the House. I mean, the House Republicans are what they are, and they're going to do what they're going to do. But senators who should, who are in theory more responsible and should know better, are going to stand there and have to choke out the words, this abuse of power that hurt a friend of the United States and aided an enemy of the United States and endangered our national security purely for the greater good of Donald John Trump is okay with me. I quit. And they're going to have to carry that around with them, not just into the 2020 cycle, but for all time as a party. And I think that that really is going to, you know, I think one of the things that saved Republicans in 1974 was, you know, when I was growing up, Republicans really prided themselves on it. And, you know, as I became a young man in the 80s, that, you know, more senior Republicans said, listen, we're the party. We are a principled party. We're the guys that went to Nixon and said, you got to go.
Yeah, that was a great moment. An important moment.
And they lived off of that moment for 30 more years to say, listen, you know, we're taking Clinton into impeachment. We're going up against, you know, Jim Wright and Tip O'Neill and all these other guys. But remember, we're the guys that took out our own president when he went too far. They are throwing that away for Trump. I mean, you know, this is kind of a man for all seasons moment, you know, but for whales.
Okay, let me push back on. Okay, by the way, I agree with everything you said, and I am like pleasantly surprised the Democrats have managed not to screw this up yet.
That is amazing. In terms of this. Yes.
It is amazing, and I think they have some very, very compelling witnesses who are going to come forward who will tell a very compelling story. What is fascinating to me is watching how all of the evidence and all of the testimony that is coming out, you know, paints a very, very consistent picture, and it is a damning picture, and each one of them supports, you know, the other. If there was any exculpatory evidence, it would have been leaked out. We would have had it. If in fact there was a really compelling alternative story, a defense of Trump, then maybe the Trump administration would not be so actively blocking the discovery efforts and the testimony, you know, from the White House. Having said all that, you know what my concern is? My concern is this whole process is going to make us even dumber than we are now. Mm-hmm. In part because what we are going to see is we're going to see all of this smoke and all of this dust and these conspiracy theories that ought to be confined to the fruitiest edges of the fever swamp are now going to become mainstream. You're going to have members of Congress on television, you know, just destroying both the facts and the logic here. And that rather than having an intelligent discussion about the constitutional issues, that we are going to be go down the rabbit hole. I mean, I thought Fiona Hill's testimony last week was really interesting. You know, former top advisor on Russia, and she talks about how these internet conspiracy theories from, you know, the fringes like InfoWars, you know, had really started to have an effect on actual public policy. Yep. And you know, she was asked about the removal of, you know, Ambassador Yovanovitch and why it marked a turning point for her. And she said it was because these accusations, you know, things like that she gave this fired Ukrainian prosecutor a do not prosecute list, had no merit whatsoever, that they was just a mishmash of conspiracy theories. And I'm just afraid that in our current poisoned information environment and political environment, that and with this desperate attempt to defend Trump no matter what, that we're going to see more of that just sort of splashing into the American mainstream. You know what I'm going?
Yeah, I do. And I have the same worry. But two things. First of all, there's no alternative at this point anyway. So it's got to happen. But I also think, you know, a lot will depend. And again, let's give a shout out to the Democrats who, you know, people like you and me, we've always relied when we were Republicans, you know, we used to say, don't worry, the Democrats will screw it up. You know, we only could count on it. They have it this time. And they are approaching this, I think, in a very focused and sensible way. I think one of the things that remains to be seen is, will these hearings be the same way? And so far, so good. I mean, I think they screwed up the Mueller hearing with this 5 minutes and, you know, 5 minutes of this. And of course, it made Mueller look like a confused old man, because even, you know, I'm a pretty healthy young guy and I was getting confused trying to follow all these people. And it was a hot mess. So let professional staff do this, keep the questioning to a minimum. And if the Republicans want to go, you know, bat crap crazy on national television, let them. They're going to do it anyway. But I think that not doing this is worse than doing it. And I think, again, once it gets to the Senate, this is why I want the House part of this to be over with as soon as possible, because I want to see Republicans standing there with John Roberts sitting in the well, you know, with the impeachment managers on both sides. And I want to see Republicans stand up and say, the straight up abuse of power that endangers national security is okay with me. They're going to have to say it, Charlie. They're going to have to.
No. Well, or they could follow the Hugh Hewitt model, which is he wants them now. He was on Meet the Press over the weekend saying that he's hoping that they just basically shut the whole thing down. Don't even bother to have a trial. Just basically receive it, you know, file it, move on, yeah. Hear no evidence, have no debate, don't have to make any explanation whatsoever.
You know, part of recovering our national health and sanity is we have to stop talking about people like Hugh Hewitt. Because that's, you know, I mean, I did an interview with Hugh before the election, and he's just become, he and a lot of other commentators just become fundamentally unserious people. And they're going to say stuff like that. But let's say for the moment that
he's on Meet the Press.
That is unfortunately not, you know, there's a lot of people that do that, but you know, it's just the way it is for now. And I think he shouldn't be, but that's how it is. But I think if the Republicans actually do that, imagine the message that sends to the entire country and to the world. I as bottomless as my cynicism about Mitch McConnell is, I don't think even Mitch McConnell is going to take take the House's vote for impeachment and drop it in a black hole.
I agree. And I think the fact that he presides over it makes it much, much more difficult to be clowned that process, because there is an inherent dignity to it that Republicans would violate, I think, at their great risk. And I know we shouldn't talk about Hugh Hewitt anymore, but this is another one of the reasons why I'm concerned about the process further dumbing us down. Watching the process of Trumpianism, what it has done to people who used to be quote unquote respected. And I'm quoted in the Daily Beast has a great story about what happened to him, and quotes me saying what's really surprising isn't just that Hewitt has become a reflexive Trump defender. It is his willingness to torch his reputation by indulging in such rank hackery. I mean, it's just embarrassing stuff. But I stand by that. I mean, who wants to sound like Lou Dobbs?
Well, but I do think that there is a demographic issue here, and I think we have to confront it. You and I are not spring chickens, Charlie, but I think this is a last hurrah among a bunch of aging old white men who, you know,
hey.
I know. I'm right here. I'm uncomfortable even saying it, but I'm going to be 59 in a month. But, you know, I think when you look at guys like Bill Barr and Rudy Giuliani and some of the enablers out there, you have basically two classes of people, you know, people that are now have such sunk costs that they're, you know, the Laura Ingrahams of the world, right? I mean, there's just no way they're going to get out of this. They're in for the ride. God knows, you know, where she's going to end up on the rubber chicken circuit 10 years from now. But for some of these older guys, what's there to lose? There is no second act. When this is over, you know, these guys are collecting their pensions, are on Social Security. And I think there is a kind of a, you know, what the hell, let's floor it and drive off the cliff sort of sense that I don't think you would have seen among some of these people when they were 40 or 45 or 50 years old.
I actually have the opposite take on all of this, which is the Laura Ingrahams, they're stuck. You know, it is sunk cost. Absolutely. You're in this far. This is who you are. This is where you're going. It is the older guys that have the luxury, which ought to have the luxury of saying, hey, I don't need this crap anymore. I do want to think about how I'm going to be remembered. I can go off into the sunset. I don't have to worry about a 20-year-long career like some of these other folks who clearly are positioning themselves. So I don't know. It's losing the handle on how crazy we're going to be.
But I think, you know, with some of these guys, it's the fear of irrelevance is worse than the fear of grim death itself.
That's true.
Just be somebody just one more time, or in Rudy's case, to be somebody and to make one more dollar. You know, in Barr's case, to go from you know that I've always said that Trump is the patron saint of the third string. You know, for people who have almost made it. I mean, Bill Barr, whose only memory of people had of him until now was kind of this tail end appointee who got some guys some pardons, you know, now saying, hey, before I leave, I'm going to, you know, I matter. I mean a lot, and I'm going to, you know, change the republic. And then he shrugs and he takes his drink of water and he says, hey, everybody dies.
I know. I don't get that. See, I can imagine, you know, again, think back when you were in your 20s, when you were just getting started. If you had a chance to ride on Air Force One, okay, if you had a chance to sit in the Oval Office and talk to the president, it might have really impressed you, right? It might have been the drug. Now that we're old white guys, it's like, okay, fine. That's great, but you know, it's I'm not actually going to set myself on fire.
But you know, Charlie, I'm going to go all literary on you for a minute.
Okay, good.
And you know, throw a line from Mephistopheles at you, from Faust, where you know Faust says to this demon, "You seem okay to me. You know, you're walking around down here. You seem to be having a good time." And he says, Mephistopheles says something to the effect of, "Do you think that I, who have tasted the joys of heaven, am not in hell continually now?" Right? That once upon a time you had it, you saw it, you were there, you've walked the halls of the Oval Office, and suddenly to be 68 years old and to be, you know, semi-retired and, you know, being interviewed for a term paper by a graduate student.
To be irrelevant. I used to be somebody important.
I was somebody, you know, I was somebody once.
That's true.
Beat that person one more time. It's like a drug. It's like a hit of crack, and they just can't say no to it.
Okay, very, very, very quick digression until we take a break here. I'm guessing that your book, The Death of Expertise, was never read by Monica Crowley. You know the reference, Monica? Now yes. She actually has a position in the State Department, right?
Monica Crowley read a lot of books and apparently quoted from some of them, which is what got her into trouble. But yeah.
No. Well, but her latest tweet that's out there, actually, it's not her latest tweet. It just was resurrected over the weekend, the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, which I found far more moving than I was expecting. I mean, it brings back so many memories and it just highlights so many of the things that are at stake. But in any case, apparently back in October of 2015, Monica Crowley had a picture taken of herself, and the caption reads, "At the Berlin Wall last week, walls work."
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
Walls work. How dumb do you have to be?
I don't think it's dumb, Charlie. I think there is a bigger problem than dumbness. And it's something I've been wrestling with for a while, which is, it's not dumbness, it's the moral poverty of these people. The kind of moral vacuousness of a Monica Crowley or a Laura Ingraham or a, you know, a Rudy Giuliani or a Hugh Hewitt, this sort of black hole at the center where a principle could have been how do you stand in front of the Berlin Wall and all you can think about is making a point about yourself and about your preferred candidate? You're standing in front of a place where people died for freedom, to get out, to escape.
Well, you assume that she knows that. There's an abyss of ignorance there that you have to assume, I think.
But she doesn't care. This isn't like some idiot teenager taking a selfie in front of Auschwitz, you know? This is somebody with a doctorate from Columbia University who ought to know better and doesn't care.
Your point about the moral vacuity of it is important, though, because it's too easy just to simply say you're dumb and you're crazy. There is something deeper there. Okay, so I feel a rant coming on here. We've been very kind to the Democrats so far about how they have not blown impeachment, but they're in the process potentially of blowing 2020, and I want to talk about that as well as the legendary epic Twitter rant that you had. and the reaction to it. So let's talk about that, Tom, right after a word from our sponsor.
Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery, just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to TryPlexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit TryPlexiderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's TryPlexiderm.com.
Okay, we're back with Tom Nichols, whose book, The Death of Expertise, by the way, probably needs to be updated on a daily basis. But, okay, so, you and I have both written articles telling the Democrats, I think we have a different approach to the Democrats at the moment, but telling the Democrats, do not blow this thing. Do not go so far left that you alienate the swing voters. And I'm sure that you saw that Rahm Emanuel, former mayor of Chicago and Barack Obama's chief of staff, has written an article that kind of sounds familiar, warning to the Democrats, pointing out that the playbook that Democrats have used to actually win elections is being ignored by the presidential candidates, who instead are going around talking about how many trillions of dollars they're going to spend, how they're going to take away your private health insurance, how they're going to legalize border crossings, give out free stuff, Green New Deal, all of that stuff. Are the Democrats going to pay more attention to those voices than the guys like us who are pretty easy to ignore?
You know, you don't even have to invoke Rahm Emanuel, who, you know, is well known for his colorful language and often generates colorful language in response from a lot of Democrats. You don't have to go there. Nancy Pelosi said it. Hillary, by God, Clinton herself said it about this issue about the Electoral College. I think some of it is, you know, you and I, a lot of our form of expression is through social media and on Twitter, where, you know, Twitter skews heavily young, heavily left, heavily woke. I think one bright spot in this is that Democratic primary voters seem resolutely unmoved by all this and have, you know, ditched Kamala and Mayor Pete. And, you know, our Sanders is still running third, I think, because that's a placeholder for when he finally drops out, who's going to get those votes. But I do think the mistake the Democrats are, well, there's two mistakes the Democrats are making. One is, despite their talk about how careful they're being, I think a fair number of Democrats really do believe that Donald Trump is toast, that it's over, that he has been abandoned by enough people, that he has no shot of pulling another inside straight in the Electoral College. And so now they are free to have an argument in public about what flavor of woke replaces Trump. And I think that's a mistake, because I think Trump, right now, I have Trump in my mind at about 60-40 as a reelect. I think the other mistake they're making is the mistake they've always made, which is that they believe, against all evidence, and I don't understand this because it really requires a massive suspension of disbelief, they believe that they would win more elections if they would just move further left. And of course, their evidence for this is Hillary Clinton's loss, to which I always say, you lost with Hillary Clinton because of Hillary Clinton, because she is a uniquely bad candidate. Barack Obama did not run to the left. I mean, Barack Obama, you know, I was one of the conservatives arguing with my fellow conservatives saying, stop calling this guy a socialist. I mean, he's a one percenter, kind of left of center, you know, big government liberal, but he's not a socialist. And I don't understand how, especially after 2018, where a lot of districts were flipped from red to blue by relatively centrist candidates, that somehow There's this wish, this childlike wish casting that says we will do better if we just move further to the left. There's no evidence for it. It's historically never been true. And yet there's a vocal and maybe not very bright element of the Democratic Party that just believes in it like a rabbit's foot, like a superstition. And if that becomes dominant, they're screwed.
Yeah, I wish I could find a bubble on social media and on cable television that would assure me that if I had a diet of eggnog that I could actually lose weight. You know, that it would be I would become younger, sexier, and lose weight if I just drank more eggnog and ate,
donuts
and burritos. It is sort of like that. It's like I really want to believe this, and if I could be reinforced over and over again, I might go for that. Okay, so speaking of social media, you had your moment in the barrel recently.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you had a bad back.
Yes, I have a bad back. And,
did this make you crankier than you normally are?
It did.
Okay.
And also, you know, it immobilized me so that I really had nothing to do but kind of sit straight with a heating pad and a pillow. But what?
And your phone.
This is what people ask me. How can you tweet so much? I work on a gigantic desktop with a big screen. Said, yeah. So I multitask. I was really appalled by the treatment, again, by Trump and by his enablers in the conservative media of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. And I said, you know, there comes a point at which when you're questioning the patriotism and the dual loyalties of a decorated combat veteran who came here as an immigrant fleeing the Soviet Union, this isn't just a political difference anymore. You're somebody that I just don't like. You're somebody that I don't, you know, it's not that we're having a difference of a political opinion. Your values are so rancid that I don't feel the need to think well of you anymore. And I this has been kind of a third rail in American politics for a long time that I think Trump has forced us all to deal with, that if you have a political disagreement, can you still be friends? Well, yeah, I have plenty of friends who are, I mean, one of my best friends is a, you know, heavy duty left wing Noam Chomsky spouting artist. I have other friends who were, you know, I lost money to a guy who's a good friend of mine who told me Trump was going to win because, you know, dumbass elitists like me didn't see it coming and I had to pay the guy. But when you say things like, it's okay to put kids in cages to deter people from immigrating to the United States, or I'm going to crap all over a guy with a purple heart and suggest that, you know, he's secretly fronting for another country because I have to protect this president. There comes a point where I have to look at you and say, you know, it's okay if we don't talk anymore. It's okay if we live separate lives. I have all the friends I need. I don't need one more who that I don't respect.
You know, I think a lot of us feel that way. You actually articulated it because, you know, it's you want to think that you can continue to talk across the divide. And I think one of the most unfortunate things that I've experienced in politics is when you lose friends because of your position. But I know exactly what you're talking about, that if you believe these things, if you believe that, you know, Seth Rich was murdered, if you believe are willing to accept the trashing of these, you know, American patriots, then, you know, why would we want to have a conversation? What can we have a conversation about if we don't have shared facts, if we don't have shared values, if basically you've identified yourself in this way? So what was the reaction you got basically to saying, I'm done with you people? Which is not the first time you said this, though, right?
No, although, you know, it's interesting because I wrote a piece, ironically enough, in The Federalist back when The Federalist a different place, back around 2015, where I said, if I lose friends over Trump, so be it. And I reposted that. They ran it. I will say this about the old Federalist. There was never any editorial interference. I wrote as I pleased. I was treated well there. I was, you know, mauled. That's why I wrote my piece picking Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. You know, things change. But I think now it's taken on a new gravity because it's, you could look at people who voted for Trump in 2016 and say, look, I understand.
Sure.
You were taking a chance. You know, Hillary Clinton was so awful. You know, I get it. And I still feel that way. You know, where I have friends who say, yeah, I voted for Trump. And I say, look, I understand. 3 years in to say, I think this president's doing a great job. That's a moment where I have to stop and look at someone and say, I'm not sure that I really share any serious values with you. And the reaction, to answer your question, it was interesting. I mean, yeah, some of the people on the left cheered me and some of the people on the right threw darts at me. I think it was interesting to see how many people sent me messages, both privately and publicly, saying, thank you for expressing my anguish, because I am anguished about this. Mm-hmm. Because we don't want to lose friends over politics. I don't, you know, if you think we need a socialized medical system like, you know, Canada or something, or Sweden, or you can be my best friend, and we can argue about that all day long. I don't draw any moral conclusions out of the fact that you think there ought to be a 90% marginal tax rate. But Trump transcends politics. He forces moral choices upon us by his actions and by the dilemmas he presents us. And when I see people that I once respected faced with a moral dilemma, you know, let's leave aside the notion of friendship for a moment. When you see Bill Bennett going on Fox, okay, seriously. I mean, the guy, you know, even after the gambling thing, I said, listen, he's, you know, we are all imperfect men. We live in a fallen world. I don't think there's any problem with Bill Bennett talking about virtue, even if he himself is a somewhat unvirtuous person. That's, you know, I don't expect that. You know, I write books about, I'm writing a book right now about how to be a good citizen. I'm not a good citizen. I have moments. But I think, you know, when you see people face a moral dilemma and willingly choose the bad purely because it's better for them, it's like watching, it's like, I'll just digress 1 second, try and say, it's like when my dad had a moment when one of his friends got the wrong change from a young cashier, mm-hmm. and he walked out and said, hey, look what she did. She gave me an extra $20. And my dad made the guy go in and give the money back. But as my father told me in later years, he said he had really had a hard time looking at his friend the same way again. Mm-hmm. Like, they had been friends for years, but, you know, keeping the extra $20 that was clearly going to come out of some young cashier's pocket. I feel that way now with a lot of the people that I know who make these decisions, where I don't hate them and I haven't, like, I'm not declaring them anathema and they should be cast out, but I feel like they're the people, like my dad felt when his friend kept that extra change. And I went, you know, a friend of mine wouldn't do that. That's just wrong.
Well, I still make distinctions between the people who are open, you know, keep their eyes open and are transactional. I get that. I don't agree with it, but I get it. Versus the ones who are prepared to basically make all of these moral compromises and watching them, you know, prostitute their intellect or defend the indefensible, because that's not necessarily required. Also, you get the sense that it's not just a moral test, but also the issues are so consequential. You know, we mentioned over the weekend we had the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, which I still think may be one of the, if not the most consequential historical events of my lifetime. Mm-hmm. You'd have to rank it up there.
Yes.
Would you agree? Absolutely. Is there anything? Absolutely. One moment.
I finally had a chance to visit that part of Berlin last year with my wife. And, you know, I walked from the Soviet military cemetery up to the Brandenburg Gate. And I wrote about it. In fact, I reposted it on my Twitter feed if anybody wants to see it. I did a piece in USA Today about it. I had the distinct sense of standing in a place where history had turned in mankind's favor for once. You know, I turned to my wife and I said, you know, if we had destroyed the planet and we were all dead, it was going to start right where we're standing. It was going to be right here.
It's very rare you can put your finger on exactly the moment where, you know, nothing happens, and all at once you have this cataclysmic, world-changing event that, you know, and that's why it was so moving over the weekend to read this. So also, I was reading this morning the excerpt from Charles Krauthammer's the posthumous book, The Point of It All. Mm-hmm. Was that posthumous? I'm not sure. But anyway, they reposted it in the Washington Post, where, you know, and by the way, we miss him so much. And this is the moment where you need voices like Charles Krauthammer. And he's talking about, he says, now, 30 years later, in a development once unimaginable, mature Western democracies are experiencing a surge of ethno-nationalism, a blood and soil patriotism tinged with xenophobia, a weariness with parliamentary dysfunction, and an attraction, still only an attraction, not yet a commitment, to strongman rule. And talks about this rise of, you know, the disillusionment with democracy and the people on the right here in this country who are now attracted to that sort of, who basically have given up on classical liberal democratic, you know, systems, and replacing it with this ethnic, tribal, nationalist, Putin-esque values. You know, this is consequential, yeah, and people are choosing sides. And once you've chosen that side, you're basically rejecting all of the traditions we thought that we had shared.
But there's one thing about choosing sides is that when you have chosen that side, it's very, very difficult to climb down. I think part of what's happening to a lot of our friends on the right, Charlie, is they're making decisions. This is why I think it's actually in some ways easier for the old men, because they're never going to have to climb back down. I think that for other people, you know, they are making decisions where the climb down is going to be really hard to do, and it's going to be painful. But I think, and I'll just tease, I mean, I won't be out for another year or so, but I'll tease the next book I'm working on, which is about exactly this problem. And I think it's because we have become a spoiled, affluent, self-indulgent, lazy society. And this is not aimed at millennials or anybody. This is
so,
all of
so us. You've decided you want to make friends again.
Well, you know, I had a big hit with a book that called everybody stupid. Now I'm just going to call everybody bad people. Yeah. But I mean, look, when even Putin, I was just reading a report before we talked today. I was doing some research. Even Putin's Russia is worried about a rise of extremism among its own youth. Now, let that sink in, right? That the Kremlin is saying, you know, guys, you know, all this right-wing ethno-nationalist crap is all well and good, but let's not let it get off the leash here. And part of the explanation was young men who are overeducated, underemployed, and spending a huge amount of time on the internet. And I am not making this up. I mean, the Russians are actually doing studies saying, what do we do about the fact that we have a bunch of man boys sitting around on the internet passing around conspiracy theories who are now rejecting not only Western forms of liberal authority, but even Putin-esque forms of authority, because they just want to, like, you know, because they all want to be the Joker.
Okay, so this will sound like a funny segue, but I was thinking of the same sort of pattern watching Don Jr. and his fiance out at the University of California. You see what happened, where basically, yes, Don Jr. is, you know, he's pimping his book and he's talking about his book, and he eventually gets shouted down by the audience, not of leftists, but of people who are part of this alt-right, who have now gone further to the right of the Trumpists. And you wonder at some point whether the Trumpists are thinking, boy, you know, I'm a little scared about this this xenophobic, conspiracy-minded nut jobs here on the right who are trying to take over, that they're viewing this group the way that we viewed them. And it's
Don Jr. Don Jr. getting shouted down by right-wing conspiracy nuts while Kimberly Guilfoyle tries to play mommy, mm-hmm, and tell them how their parents would disapprove of them has to be one of the most delicious kind of, you know, end of empire moments that I've ever seen. And I'm actually not that worried about it, because I think the kind of kids who do this, the kind of young guys who do this, these guys couldn't organize a fire in an oil refinery. I mean, these are not, you know, these are not the brown shirts. This is not 1933. This is a bunch of chumps who basically spend too much time seeking self-affirmation. And I think that's running rampant throughout Western society, from Hungary through Russia to the United States to Great Britain. But I think that in some ways, Trump became the avatar of this. Trump Sr. became the avatar of it because Trump is the total, I don't give a, I know we're on radio, but I'll keep it clean. Trump is the original YOLO guy. He's the original, I'll just lie and bluster and threaten because that works. He's this, someone once referred to him on NPR as the aspirational a-hole for young men.
Yeah. Exactly.
And, you know, that doesn't have a lot of staying power. I mean, eventually you have to kind of, you know, sober up and go get a job and get married and do all those other things.
Or shift to the harder drugs.
Well, yes.
Go further down the rabbit hole.
But the problem with that is it does a lot of damage to institutions in the meantime. And again, the people out there, the Hewitts and, you know, the Fox News people. And, you know, now that we don't have a voice of moral clarity like Charles Krauthammer, we don't have anybody trying to right the ship to say these things are wrong. And that's partly why I had this kind of creed occur while I was trying to keep my back straight to say, you know, at some point we're just going to have to turn to each other and say, it's not only politically bad for you to think this, you're free to do that as a citizen, but I'm going to withdraw my personal affection from you or my personal bond of friendship from you because this is turning you into a bad person and you need to pay some kind of price for that. You need to be shunned in some way for that because I think that's in the end, that's the last guardrail of human society is that, you know, we don't, how do we know that it's like when Roy Moore ran in the Senate, right? Yes, we have laws about not dating young girls, but we also have a social set of mores. When I was in college, if you walked into a party with a 15-year-old girl, you know, a bunch of guys come over and say, you need to take Bambi here and go home. You know, you can't be here. This is wrong. And I think at some point we have to become that way again. You know, I know it's kind of a case for judgmentalism, but I think that when the institutions, including the public intellectuals, stop doing their job, we have to turn to each other and say, you know, no, it's not okay to put kids in cages. No, it's not okay to be a mall creeper running for Senate. No, it's not okay to smear a Purple Heart winner just because it's politically efficacious for you. We're just going to have to do that. It's not going to be pleasant, but I think it's necessary.
This is why you should get a dog. I'm just telling you. This is why dogs are much more reliable.
One of the most famous cat people on the internet.
That's why I'm telling you this. Look, at the end of this, we're not going to have any friends whatsoever except for our pets. So, I mean, you know, we might as well embrace that. That this is our future, and we're okay with it.
My cat is a Burkean conservative. She totally gets me.
Okay. Tom Nichols, thanks so much for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it very, very much.
Great to be with you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening. Today's episode was brought to you by Plexiderm. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow. And of course, we'll do this all over again.